They said the killer was dead, that the murders had stopped, that justice had been served. But when a woman's body is found in a motel outside Pittsburgh, posed the exact same way as a victim from 1994, one analyst knows something is wrong. Dr. Mara Ellison has spent her life profiling the darkest minds in criminal history. She's seen cruelty. She's seen obsession. But nothing prepared her for this. Each new body across the Midwest reopens wounds she thought she'd buried, especially when the killer begins sending her letters, each signed with the symbol of a man long buried. As Mara dives deeper, the lines between past and present blur, and a disturbing question emerges. Did they catch the wrong man? Or has someone been watching her all along, waiting for the perfect moment to begin again? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Body in Room 16. From the thriller, Disturbing Patterns. Dr. Mara Ellison had stopped believing in coincidences years ago. She sat at the edge of her bed, the light from her laptop flickering across her face as she stared at the image on the screen. The body was arranged like an exhibit, legs straight, arms across the chest, a white sheet pulled just beneath the chin. The photo had been taken by first responders at a budget motel off Interstate 79, just north of Pittsburgh. She had seen this pose before, almost exactly, but that couldn't be possible. The timestamp in the corner said 2:42 a.m. The file name had come attached to an encrypted message from a former colleague at the Bureau. Subject line, "Need your eyes on this ASAP." Mara's chest tightened. She zoomed in. The woman, Caucasian, mid-30s, dark hair, lay expressionless on the mattress, her skin pale under the neon motel lighting. A single daisy was placed on the pillow beside her. Fresh, white, symbolic. That detail struck her like a slap. The daisy wasn't decoration, it was signature. She whispered the name she hadn't said aloud in 12 years. James August. A dead man. A serial killer caught in 1997, tried in 1998, and confirmed dead by execution in 2003. His murders had spanned over a decade, 18 women, all left posed in rented rooms with a single daisy beside them. The press had called him the hotel poet because he'd always left a note, written in tight, slanted cursive. But this crime scene was new, fresh, unpublicized, no poem this time, just the daisy. Mara closed the laptop and sat in silence, hearing only the faint hum of the refrigerator and the tapping of her heartbeat in her ears. Her phone buzzed on the nightstand, a number she didn't recognize. She picked up without saying hello. "Dr. Ellison." The voice was clipped, male, confident. "Yes." "You've seen it?" "I have." A pause. "What do you think?" "I think someone's either trying to get my attention, or they've studied James August too closely." "Then you're already ahead of everyone else." He hung up. She sat frozen, phone still to her ear. This wasn't supposed to happen. After August's execution, she had changed departments, left fieldwork, and buried the memories in a locked drawer with the rest of the trauma she didn't talk about. His case had consumed her. For years, she had profiled his every move, chased his shadows, analyzed his love of symmetry and sadism. She even testified at his trial. But this was a resurrection. 6 hours earlier, Fairview Inn, Room 16. The housekeeper had smelled the copper tang before she saw the body. Her knock had gone unanswered. Checkout was at noon, and it was nearly 2 p.m. When she cracked the door open, her hands flew to her face. The woman on the bed didn't look dead at first. She looked arranged, carefully placed, like something meant to be found. There was no sign of struggle, no forced entry, no defensive wounds, no blood splatter, just the body, clean and cold, and the flower, Police found no ID, no credit card. The room had been paid for in cash the night before by a man using the name Samuel Hayes, an alias connected to no real identity. The front desk clerk remembered nothing except that he was polite, alone, wore gloves when handing over the cash. The security camera facing the parking lot had been disabled, wires clipped, footage erased, precise, surgical, like someone who had done this before. Back in D.C., FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit, Quantico. By 11 a.m. the next morning, Mara was in a black SUV, her bureau credentials reactivated for consulting purposes. They didn't ask twice. When a killer leaves behind a ritual and there's someone in the country who's memorized that ritual, they call her. The drive to the Pittsburgh field office was mostly quiet, except for the sharp chirps of the police scanner and the soft rustling of pages in her old field notes. She had pulled the August files from her attic, water-stained, ink-faded, but intact. Each murder was detailed with obsessive care. Each one occurred in a different city, always in a motel, always with a daisy placed on the pillow, and always after a long, quiet period of silence. But there had never been a confirmed accomplice, never a copycat. Until now. As she entered the briefing room, a young detective stood and offered a file. Dr. Ellison, I'm Detective Morgan, big fan of your work. Mara didn't smile. No one who says that has ever actually read my work. He gave an awkward laugh and gestured toward the table, where crime scene photos, motel logs, and handwritten transcriptions of 911 calls were spread out. She examined the photos again, this time in print. The daisy was fresh. No wilting. That meant it had been picked, not bought. Wildflowers in early October weren't common this far north. That meant the killer traveled with it. Intentional. Methodical. She asked the only question that mattered now. Where's the nearest botanical garden? The memory that wouldn't die. That night, alone in the motel provided by the Bureau, Mara couldn't sleep. The last time she had seen James August was through the glass of a high-security prison. He was lean, unremarkable, forgettable. Until he spoke. Then his voice wrapped around you like silk and wire. I don't kill for pleasure, he had said, brushing invisible lint from his cuffs. I kill for composition. The words haunted her now. She had believed then that his obsession with symmetry and posing was about trauma, about control. But what if it was something else? What if this was a continuation? What if August had planned for someone to carry on his work? She opened her laptop again, hands trembling, and began typing a name she had never spoken aloud before. Eli August, his son. Chapter 2. Legacy in Blood. From the fiction thriller Disturbing Patterns. The Bureau had buried every trace of Eli August. That was Mara's first thought as she stared at the screen. No birth certificate. No arrest record, no photos. The name triggered only one ping, an old psychiatric case file sealed under court order. The file ID matched a clinic in Baltimore, Briarhill Psychiatric Center for Youth. She clicked deeper. The file was sparse, redacted in all the wrong places. Patient, EA age, 13. Diagnosis, dissociative identity disorder, secondary trauma. Guardian, classified. But the admission date struck her. May 17, 1997. Exactly 1 week after James August's arrest. A cold weight spread through her chest. James August had a son, and someone had made sure no one could find him. The meeting. Detective Morgan met her at the car the next morning, steaming coffee in hand. He wore the same jacket from yesterday, now rain-dampened at the sleeves. You look like hell, he said. Mara took the coffee. That's because I didn't sleep. She tossed him a file. Eli August, James's son, institutionalized in Baltimore. The records are locked down, but someone slipped. Morgan flipped through the pages. You think he's our guy? I think we never knew how deep this went. If Eli's alive and he's been hiding, this body wasn't just a copycat. It was a message. Morgan glanced over at the photos still taped to the crime board in the briefing room. What kind of message? Mara didn't blink. Legacy, inheritance. He's telling us this pattern isn't dead. It's evolving. The Baltimore File. By noon, they were inside Briarhill's sealed archives. The hospital administrator, a hollow-eyed man with gray stubble and trembling hands, clearly wanted no part of what was coming. We were told never to speak of this patient again, he said, unlocking the final drawer. Eli's full file was there, thick, yellowed, and bound with a rubber band so tight it had dug into the pages. Mara peeled it open, careful not to tear the brittle edges. Page by page, she saw the timeline of a boy unraveling. Drawings, violent ones, flowers bleeding, women with hollow eyes and twisted limbs, page after page of hotel rooms, always symmetrical, always labeled, practice, study, finale. One therapist's note stood out. Eli mimics the rituals of his father's crimes. He does not fantasize about them. He rehearses them. We believe he considers the original killings incomplete. He speaks of needing to fix the composition. Her blood ran cold. One final entry, dated just before Eli's discharge at age 18, simply read, "The subject is ready. He believes he is no longer a shadow, but the artist." The second body. The call came that night. Another woman, same staging, motel room in Toledo, Ohio, 2 days apart, same daisy, same pose. This time, the daisy was pressed between the pages of the motel Bible, left open to Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept. Mara swallowed hard. That was James August's favorite passage. He quoted it during his trial, called it the sound of sorrow in symmetry. But this crime was more precise, cleaner. There was a sense of mastery. She turned to Morgan. He's not copying James. Morgan frowned. Then what is he doing? He's finishing the work. Pattern recognition. They built the map in silence. Two murders, 298 miles apart, both in low-rent motels, just off main highways, the bodies posed the same way. No fingerprints, no DNA, no CCTV. But when Mara drew a line between Pittsburgh and Toledo, she paused. If I were creating a signature, she said slowly, I wouldn't just mimic a method. I'd follow a shape. Morgan leaned over the map. Shape? She extended the line across state boundaries, then down toward Lexington, Kentucky. A triangle, she murmured. Equilateral? Exactly. James was obsessed with geometry. So if Eli's honoring the structure, the third kill completes the triangle. Morgan stared. You think he's planning the next one? Mara nodded. And we have 2 days. Ghosts of the Father. That night, Mara revisited old recordings from James August's prison interviews. She had archived over 30 hours of audio, most of it chilling, some of it eerily poetic. She queued up one tape labeled simply May 4th, 2002. He watches me, you know, August had said. My son. Not with hate. With understanding. He knows where I failed. He sees how beauty became noise. But him. He'll finish the arrangement. He'll make it sing. Mara sat still, goosebumps rising along her arms. Then she heard something she had missed before. I told him where to begin. A motel. A flower. A name dot. The flower was obvious. The motel was the setting. But the name, she played it back 3 more times. A name. Could Eli be using an alias from James's past? She opened the motel logs, Room 16 had been booked by Samuel Hayes. She checked James's court files. No mention of the name. Then she searched deeper, prison visitation records. In 2001, James August had received only one visitor, listed as Reverend Samuel Hayes. Not a reverend, a cover, a young man, 18 years old, Eli. The countdown begins. Mara packed her bag. "We're leaving," she told Morgan. "He's completing the triangle, which means we're not chasing him. He's leading us. The third kill isn't random. It's personal." Morgan zipped up his laptop. "Where?" She looked at the map again. Her finger tapped the empty space at the triangle's southern tip. "Louisville." "Why there?" Her voice dropped. "Because that's where his mother died." Chapter 3. The Third Room. From the fiction thriller, Disturbing Patterns. The motel in Louisville was a place time had forgotten. Its neon sign buzzed like an exhausted insect, casting a sickly red glow over the cracked parking lot. Starview Inn, daily and weekly rates, flickered with every gust of wind. No one inside asked questions. No one ever did. Room 11 was registered to S. Hayes 2 days ago. Paid in cash. 2 nights. No maid service requested. Mara and Detective Morgan stood outside the door just before sunrise, the air thick with early morning humidity. Across the lot, uniformed officers waited, breath held. "Ready?" Morgan asked. Mara nodded, heart thudding. Her hand hovered over the doorknob. They entered together. The smell was instant, sweet, chemical, wrong. Formaldehyde. Something had been cleaned. The room looked untouched at first glance. The bed was made. The Bible was closed. But as Mara stepped closer, she saw it. On the pillow was the daisy, still fresh. And on the dresser, a note. Handwritten. Neat, slanted cursive. It read, "Composition complete. But she is the missing chord. I want her to hear the final song. Beneath it, a single name. Mara." No body, no blood, just intent. For the first time, there was no body. The room had been staged, but nothing had happened, yet. It was a message, a performance before the final act, a calling card not just for law enforcement, but for her. Morgan's voice was sharp. "He's escalating. This was meant for you." Mara stared at the daisy, rage and nausea twisting inside her. "He's shifting focus. No longer just completing a pattern. Now he's drawing me into it." Morgan checked the room's outlets. "Hidden cameras." "Too easy," Mara muttered. "This isn't about surveillance. It's about symbolism. Ritual. He's evolving. He wants me part of the finale." Then she noticed something. The Bible wasn't just closed, it was sealed with wax. Pressed into the wax was a symbol, a perfect triangle. At its center, a single line through the base. The triangle had closed, the pattern was complete. But the vertical line? That was new. "What is that?" Morgan asked, photographing it. "A break," Mara whispered, "a fracture. The triangle's perfect until it isn't." The connection to the past. Louisville wasn't just where Eli's mother had died. It was where James August met her, the woman he called the Melody. Her name was Clarissa Gentry, a music student who vanished in 1983. The police never connected her to the string of motel killings because no body was found. But Mara had always suspected. She remembered James's final interview, how he'd said, "She was the only one I didn't pose. She refused composition." Clarissa hadn't been killed in the ritual. She'd rejected it, and in doing so, she'd broken his pattern. Now, Eli was invoking her. "His mother was the fracture," Mara said aloud. "She broke the rhythm. And now, he thinks I'm the echo." Morgan looked at her. "He's reenacting his father's failures." "Not reenacting," she said, her voice low, correcting. The home of the melody. They followed the trail to the University of Louisville. Clarissa's old records had long been digitized, transcripts, performance schedules, a few student reviews of her recitals. But one document stood out, a rehearsal program from 1983. She was scheduled to perform Debussy's Clair de Lune on the night she disappeared. Mara sat down slowly, staring at the piece title. It meant Light of the Moon. Suddenly, the wax-sealed Bible made sense. The triangle, the line, the moon. She pulled up satellite maps of the three motels. Each one had a room facing east, facing moonrise. Each time of death, roughly between 1 and 3 a.m., coincided with full moon nights. It wasn't random. It was orchestration. The composer's final act. That night, Mara checked herself into the motel. Same style, same layout. Room 8 this time, facing east. She didn't tell Morgan, didn't notify the bureau. She needed to feel the space as he would, needed to be the note he was composing. She placed a daisy on her own pillow. Waited. Nothing. Then, just after 2:15 a.m., a soft knock. Three taps, silence, two taps. She didn't breathe. Her hand slid to the gun beneath her pillow. Another knock. Mara rose and moved to the door. She placed her eye against the peephole. No one there. Then she saw it. On the ground outside her door, another daisy, and a folded piece of paper. She opened the door slowly, retrieved the note, then closed it and locked all three deadbolts. The note was different. Typed, cold, detached. You're out of rhythm, Mara. This room was never part of the symphony. But don't worry. Your finale has already begun. She flipped the page. An address, back in Washington, D.C. The stakes turned personal. It was her home, her real home, not the apartment she kept near Quantico for work, but her childhood home, the one she'd inherited from her mother. It had sat empty for over a year. She hadn't given that address to anyone. No one knew about it, not even Morgan. Her hands trembled as she dialed him. Pack your bag, she said. He's not going to kill strangers anymore. Morgan's voice was tight. What are you saying? I'm saying the pattern has shifted. He's not following his father anymore? No, she said. He's following me. Chapter 4. The House That Knew Her Name. From the fiction thriller, Disturbing Patterns, the house on Linden Grove had stood untouched for years. Tall, narrow, and hidden behind a rusting iron gate, it had belonged to Mara's mother until her death, a structure frozen in time. White paint peeled from its columns. Weeds choked the stone steps. But the bones of the place were intact, strong, solid. It was never a home, only a memory. As she and Morgan pulled up in silence, Mara's gut twisted. The street was empty. The air, still. No sign of forced entry. No broken windows. No kicked-in door. But something felt different. Wrong. He had been here. She could feel it in the way the wind carried nothing, in the way the gate, once rusted shut, swung open too easily. Morgan stepped out first, hand on his holstered weapon. You sure this is the address from the note? Mara nodded. He's bringing it back to origin, she said quietly. Not his, mine. The house inside her head. The interior was just as she remembered. The soft creak of old wood beneath her boots, the faded green wallpaper that curled at the edges like parchment. Her mother's mirror still stood in the front hallway, its silver frame tarnished with time. Dust floated through the beams of sunlight like ash in a cathedral. Mara walked forward, past the living room, through the narrow hall into the dining space. That's where she saw it. The chair at the head of the table had been pulled out. A daisy lay centered on the plate. Morgan raised his gun, voice sharp. Clear the rest of the house. Mara nodded and moved to the back stairs. Room by room, they swept it. Nothing. No intruder. No note. No camera. Just that silent message waiting in the dining room like a dinner invitation. You lived here. I've been here too. Now this place belongs to both of us. The childhood file. Back at Quantico, Mara pulled her sealed psychological file from the archives. It was her own. She had entered therapy at the Bureau's request in 2003, after the August case ended and the nightmares refused to stop. She was young then, barely 30, hardened by the job but unprepared for the toll of obsession. She flipped to one entry dated March 10, 2004. Subject shows signs of unresolved childhood trauma. Has described her home as a place where sound went to die. Emotional repression. Possible disassociation. Fixation on patterns as a form of control. She stared at the words. They felt like someone else's. But they were hers. Then she flipped to the next page and gasped. There, in a therapist's doodle box, usually filled with scribbled lines or notes, was a perfect triangle, with a vertical line running through the base. The same symbol Eli had left in the wax seal. It had been drawn during a session. She had described it to the therapist. But how? Who else had seen this? She turned to the cover sheet. Her primary therapist, Dr. L. Winslow. But she remembered him differently now. He always wore gloves, and he never used his first name. Back to the beginning. She and Morgan traced the file back to the old therapy center, now repurposed as a private wellness institute in Northern Virginia. The receptionist couldn't locate Dr. L. Winslow in their alumni records, so they searched old staff photos. There, in a faded group image from 2004, stood a tall, lean man in a beige coat. Mara's breath caught. He was younger then, but the eyes were the same. She zoomed in on the name tag. It didn't say Winslow. It said E. Gentry. Morgan leaned in. Wait, Gentry? Mara whispered it. Clarissa Gentry. That was Eli's mother. Morgan's voice cracked. You think? Her brother, Mara said. Or cousin, maybe even a fake name. But this man inserted himself into my life before I even realized I had become a part of his. The first tape. That night, an unmarked envelope arrived at Mara's temporary residence. No return address, no postage. Inside, a cassette tape. Handwritten across the label, Composition Begins. They had to borrow an old tape deck from evidence storage just to play it. As the hiss of static gave way, a voice emerged, calm, controlled, familiar. Mara, I've been inside your head longer than you've known your own reflection. You think you studied me, but you were only looking in the mirror. Your mother died in silence. Mine died screaming, but both left us incomplete. A pause, then music. A recording of Clair de Lune, faint and warbling. Then the voice again. One final movement, one final room. Meet me where the moonlight began. Room 23. No weapons, just you, or the symphony ends in chaos. Click. The meaning of Room 23. Mara sat in silence for minutes, maybe hours. Then she spoke. Room 23. Morgan nodded slowly. Clair de Lune. The Debussy performance Clarissa was supposed to give before she vanished. It was held in room 23 of the Fine Arts Hall at Louisville. She looked up, eyes burning. He's ending it where she was supposed to begin. Morgan's voice dropped. You can't go alone. Mara met his gaze. I don't have a choice. Chapter 5. The Composer's Trap. From the fiction thriller, Disturbing Patterns. Room 23 smelled of old velvet and silence. It sat at the far end of the University of Louisville's Fine Arts Building, untouched for decades. Its once polished hardwood floor was faded to ash, and the red curtains above the stage hung heavy with dust and forgotten sound. This was where Clarissa Gentry should have played Claire de Lune in 1983, where the music was meant to begin. Now, it had become the final note of something far more sinister. Mara stood at the center of the room, surrounded by silence that pulsed like breath. The bureau had cleared the area. Snipers were positioned on adjacent rooftops. Tactical officers waited in unmarked vans. But inside room 23, Mara was alone. That was the agreement. Eli had demanded it. No weapons, no wires, no backup. Just her, and whatever truth awaited in the dark. The setup. At the edge of the stage stood a piano. Grand, black, covered in dust, but carefully restored for tonight. A single daisy rested on its lid. Behind it, a chair. Facing her. Empty. For now, the only light came from the moon outside, falling through the tall stained glass window, pooling silver onto the center of the floor. Mara stepped into the circle of light. Her heart pounded like a drum roll. Then a sound, the slow, echoing creak of the side door opening. Footsteps. Measured, confident. From the shadows emerged a man in his early 30s. Tall, clean-shaven, with ash-blonde hair and eyes that seemed to absorb the light. He wore a fitted black coat. Gloves. No weapon. He looked like someone who had practiced this walk in his mind for years. "Hello, Dr. Ellison," he said. His voice was smooth, emotionless. She didn't speak, just stared. Eli August stopped 5 feet away. "You've seen my work," he said. "Now you're part of it." The philosophy of killing. "You were in my house," she said quietly. He tilted his head. "Not to harm you, to learn. To see where the cracks began." "You've been watching me." "Longer than you know," he said. She clenched her fists. "Why now?" He walked to the piano, resting a hand on the daisy. "Because my father's work was unfinished," he said. "He saw beauty, but lacked precision. Emotion clouded him. You made sense of him. You decoded the pattern. That's why you're here." She took a breath. "You think I'm part of the art?" "No," he said, smiling faintly. "You're the last note." The offer. He gestured to a second chair, placed opposite the piano. "Sit," he said. "Let's finish this together." She didn't move. "You murdered 3 women. He looked surprised. "Number I composed them, each a reflection, each a tone." She stepped forward, voice hard. "They were people, not chords, not movements." He smiled again. "You call them victims. I call them resonance." Her skin crawled. "You want me to understand you?" she said. "You're just a sad, broken child hiding behind metaphors." He didn't flinch. "You know what I think?" he asked, stepping closer. "I think you've always been afraid of the mirror, because deep down, you recognize the pattern in yourself." She froze. "I studied you," he said, "not just the case files. You, the way you eat, walk, dream, your need for control, for perfection. Your mother taught you silence. Mine taught me screams. But both were teachers." She felt her hands shaking. "I'm not like you." He leaned close, whispered. "Yes, you are." The confession. Suddenly, he stepped back, unbuttoning his coat. Inside, not a weapon, a recorder. He clicked play. The room filled with sound, a woman's voice, panicked, breathing hard. "I'm Clarissa. If anyone finds this, he's my son, Eli. He's not right. He talks to people who aren't there. He draws me dead. I'm afraid." Click. Silence. He tossed the recorder to the floor. "She tried to leave me," he said. I didn't kill her, but she gave me the shape. Mara's voice was hollow. The pattern. She taught me that beauty is painful, he said. You taught me that beauty must be precise. Then, from his pocket, he drew a small blade. Not raised, not threatening. He placed it on the piano. It's time to end this, he said. One of us dies tonight. The choice. Mara stared at the blade. You want me to kill you? No, he said. I want you to choose. He pointed to the tape recorder on the table. Inside it is everything. Names, dates, confessions, a full record of what I've done, what I planned. And if I kill you, I don't get the tape. He smiled. If you kill me, you end the music, but no one hears the final performance. She looked at the blade, then at the recorder, then at him. The gunshot. Outside the building, a single sharp sound broke the stillness. Inside, the tactical team moved. By the time they burst through the door, Mara stood over Eli, breathing hard. The blade lay untouched on the floor. He knelt, wrists bound in zip ties, eyes glassy. On the piano, the recorder played Clair de Lune. Mara didn't speak. She walked out in silence. Chapter 6. The Truth in the Tape. From the fiction thriller, Disturbing Patterns. The tape recorder was old, mechanical, the kind that whined slightly before each click. Mara sat alone in the Bureau's forensic review room, the lights dimmed low, headphones over her ears. It had been 24 hours since Eli August was taken into federal custody. 24 hours since Room 23, since Clair de Lune played its final note. She pressed play. The tape clicked. If you're hearing this, I'm either dead, or you chose the story over the silence. Good. Silence was never honest. Stories are. Eli's voice was steady. Too steady. I didn't kill Clarissa Gentry, but I watched her leave the world. She tried to run from the pattern. She called it madness, but it was music. I was the note she didn't want to hear. My father composed in fragments. I compose in full. Mara's eyes didn't blink. The voice continued. There's a second set of victims. Unclaimed, unlinked, but they belong to the same score. The Daisy murders weren't 18. They were 24. Six were never discovered. They were part of my training. He taught me in shadows, through letters, drawings, symbols. The Bureau never found them because they were before the case began. Mara froze. This was new, unconfirmed, horrifying. She scribbled down a list as Eli continued naming cities. Akron, Knoxville, Trenton, Biloxi. Each marked by a daisy, each left outside public buildings or bus stations. I didn't want to be my father, he said. I wanted to be the conductor. The confession spiral. The rest of the tape descended into something darker. Eli recounted not only the murders, but the rituals, the planning, the months of watching Mara from a distance, how he had applied to be her graduate intern under a false name, how he'd sat in her lectures, how she had inspired him. You taught me about fracture, he said, that every pattern must break to grow. So I broke you. The daisy in room 16 was never for the victim. It was for you. Mara stood, pulled the headphones off, and left the room without a word. FBI debrief, 3:15 p.m. Detective Morgan met her in the debriefing chamber. His eyes were dark, his sleeves rolled high. They finished processing the tape, he said. It's admissible and terrifying. She nodded. There were more victims, she said. Six, if what he said is true. We've started digging. No official matches yet, but we'll find them. He paused. How are you holding up? Mara didn't answer. Instead, she looked out the window. He didn't want to be caught. He wanted to be known. Immortalized. Morgan leaned against the desk. We won't let him control the narrative. But Mara wasn't so sure. The media storm. By the next morning, news had already leaked. Daisy killer copycat caught in Louisville. James August's son confesses to secret murders. Behavioral analyst played key role in capture. Photos of Mara were plastered on screens, papers, blogs. Interviews were requested. Books proposed. News vans circled the bureau parking lot like vultures. She refused them all, because something still didn't make sense. Eli had confessed to everything. Everything but one thing. The unanswered room. Room 16, the first body. All three confirmed victims matched his method. The posing, the daisy, the signature. But not the timeline. That woman, unlike the others, had defensive wounds. Bruising on her hands, scratches on her attacker. Eli had none. No scarring, no trace of struggle. And the daisy at that scene? Forensically tested. Covered in a unique blend of urban air pollutants not present at the other two crime scenes. Someone else placed it. Someone who knew the pattern before Eli acted. Someone who may have started the game before he ever picked up the conductor's baton. The video message. That night, Mara returned home. Another envelope awaited her at the door. Inside, a USB drive. No markings. She plugged it into her laptop. A single file loaded. Untitled .mp4. It opened on blackness, then static, then a face. Not Eli. Older, grayer, eyes like winter, James August, recorded sometime before his execution. "If my son finds this," he said slowly, "he's already begun." But he wasn't my only legacy. There were others. Notes in the same key, variations on the theme. She knows how it ends. She always has. He smiled. "Hello, Mara. Did you really think the pattern started with me?" Static. Then silence. Chapter 7. The Final Variation. From the fiction thriller, Disturbing Patterns. There was always one last chord, Mara thought. Not loud, not climactic, just soft, dissonant. The one note you almost miss until it keeps playing long after the music ends. The Return to Ashford Hills. The next morning, Mara drove alone to a place she'd sworn never to revisit. Ashford Hills State Hospital. Closed since 2009. A facility for the criminally insane. The place where James August spent his final year before transfer to death row. But that wasn't the reason she came. She came because of what wasn't in the files. A period unaccounted for. 4 weeks in 2001. Transferred, not for health, but for evaluation. That was the official note. She had read the files dozens of times over the years, but only now, after the video message, after Eli's confession, did she notice the anomaly. While there, James was under the care of a doctor, Leonid Harrow, a man who had vanished in 2003, and whose initials matched the signature scrawled on the original Daisy case photos, L.H., inside the forgotten wing. Ashford Hills had been gutted. Broken glass crunched beneath Mara's boots. Vines crawled through shattered windows. In the east wing, old patient files lay strewn across the floor like leaves. Room 9B was locked. She kicked it open. Inside, dust blanketed everything, except for the wall. Dozens of photographs had been pinned there. Women, motels, daisies. Some she recognized. Some had never been in any official case file. At the center of the wall, a Polaroid. Herself, taken from a distance, at a gas station outside D.C. She turned slowly and saw the desk, a recorder, a journal, and a sealed envelope with her name scrawled in ink. Final Variation. The True Composer. Back at the Bureau, they confirmed the journal's contents. Dr. Leonid Harrow had never existed. He was a cover, a creation, a ghost. Real identity. Lucas Hartley, a former symphony conductor turned music therapist. Obsessed with symmetry, geometry, death rituals in classical cultures, and the first man to correspond with James August. They had exchanged dozens of letters over 2 years, each blending philosophy, music, and death. Lucas never killed anyone himself, but he orchestrated. He taught James, and he found Eli, and then he found others, copycats. He wasn't the killer. He was the composer, a cult of pattern, a movement in blood. The Underground Network. The journal described it in chilling detail. Hartley recruited from prisons, psychiatric clinics, art schools, lonely, brilliant men who felt invisible. He gave them names, missions, a pattern to follow. Each crime scene was a movement, each killer an instrument, each victim another note in the symphony. The daisy wasn't just a flower. It was a symbol, a conductor's cue. Eli was only one of many, and the body in room 16. A first movement, set not by Eli, but by Hartley's newest protege. Still active, still watching. The choice. The Bureau wanted to shut it all down, bury it. Too many questions, too many unknowns. The implications could shatter public trust. But Mara made a decision. She went public. A live press conference, not to glorify the killers, but to expose the pattern, to warn the world, to break the music. This was never about one man, she said into the cameras. It was never just James August or Eli. It was about silence, about how we ignore what doesn't make sense, until the pattern completes itself in blood. She stepped down, no questions, no applause, just the truth. 1 month later, final scene. Mara walked the hills behind her mother's old house. Autumn wind tugged at her coat. She sat in the grass. Alone. Then she saw it. A small white daisy. Fresh. Deliberately placed. At her feet. And beside it. A sheet of music paper. Blank. Except for the title. Variation 2. In Her Key.